Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, as the saying goes, no pain, no gain, or good things come to those who wait. Well, if you're a commuter who uses Highway 50 regularly, it has been a long 2.5 years and there's still a ways to go. The construction project known as Fix 50 broke ground in November of 2020, and it has been a source of some angst for drivers as they navigate the lane changes, construction equipment, and bottleneck traffic. It's a roughly 2.5 mile stretch through downtown Sacramento between Highway 99 and I-5. Well, the good news is that on paper, the project is more than halfway done, let's say 70%. And if everything stays on track, Caltrans says that the project should wrap up by the end of next year, December of 2024, or even early 2025. And the payoff will be new carpool lanes, a smoother ride, and hopefully less congestion. So joining us now with an update on the Fix 50 project is Caltrans Public Information Officer Dennis Keaton. And for full disclosure, Caltrans is an underwriter of CAP Radio. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning.
So on the Fix 50 website, it says the completion date could be by late 2024. So when you drive it, it does feel like and look like progress has been made in the last 2.5 years. What can you tell us about the timeline?
The timeline is not necessarily firm, because what we've always been trying to do is try to speed up certain sections of the project that's being currently worked on to see how much time we can save. That's one of the beauties of the design build project, is that you've got the constant contact with the contractor, different parts of the actual construction team, to see where we can actually improve on some of the timeline. And the beauty of a design build project is right off the bat, it had cut off 6 months from the actual design phase, because on a traditional project, it takes longer. So going the design build route, you're saving 6 months, and that's what got us to start sooner rather than later.
Hmm. Tell us about the scope of the project. It starts and ends where?
Well, it's actually a continuation of a project from about 8 to 9 years ago that started in El Dorado Hills, if you don't remember, at the El Dorado-Sacramento County line, and ended at Watt Avenue. So that's where we're picking up at, is from Watt Avenue to the I-5 interchange, where they're going to be continuing to do the pavement rehabilitation, doing some more structure work. That gap that you see in between the east and westbound directional for US 50 has to be filled in, because that's where the new lanes are going to be put in. So part of the time-consuming effort is that you have an elevated highway that is going to need new structures to fill in that gap. And then you're also redoing the whole lane configuration, because you're taking up the old concrete and replacing it. And you're talking about 2 feet of depth all the way from one side to the other to try to get this completed.
Hmm. So on the one hand, we're adding more lanes to hopefully reduce congestion along this stretch of Highway 50. But you're also talking about removing concrete pavement that dates back decades, like to the late 1960s to 1970s. So on the one hand, it's hopefully relieving congestion, but it's also doing some improvements to the existing infrastructure.
Absolutely, because you're talking about an infrastructure that's aged, that's kind of out of date, because the population's grown. Sacramento is no longer that small to medium-sized city when this highway was first constructed. Now it's a medium-large city. So we've got to change, and that's part of the change that's going on here. You're also talking about quite a bit of electrical work that's being done, updated on what's like ramp meters and a communication network. We're also talking about drainage, improving the drainage so that you don't see as much pooling waters that's been typically seen every time we've had a big storm.
Hmm. When it comes to the major improvements, can you lay out some of them for us, what the project will have once it's completed?
Once it's completed, our goal is to make sure that traffic flows much smoother and just a lot less congestion going through that Midtown East Sacramento area known as the WX. That part of that is the auxiliary lanes that are going to also be included on this project, because what's going to happen is that's going to allow folks to be able to exit sooner rather than later and stay on the main line. And we've seen great improvement, for one example, on a project like FixSAC 5, Interstate 5, where that's greatly improved the traffic flow. We also heard naysayers back about 5-6 years ago saying that those bus carpool lanes won't really improve Interstate 80. Well, they have. They've improved dramatically how much the traffic flow is through North Sacramento. So that's what our anticipation is to see with this continuation project of the new carpool lanes, wider gaps where you're going to be able to leave the interstate and exit sooner. So that's what we're really looking for, is an improved traffic flow overall.
It's important to, when describing this stretch, I mean, there's a good amount of kind of tricky merging that you have to do, because there's Highway 99, and then you have, you know, as you mentioned, the WX, but then Business 80, which is coming from, like, if you're heading from Cal Expo. So you can merge and then merge again. How will this construction help alleviate that kind of tricky situation for a lot of drivers, especially if they're not from the area and they're not aware of how much merging they're going to have to do?
You know, that's a real good point, because being familiar with the area can make all the difference. Part of this project is improving the signage and actually getting notifications sooner rather than later. So what you're going to have is larger signs, clearer signs, more points of direction. Points of entry, such as the on-ramps, are going to be much more visible. Those auxiliary lanes that I was talking about earlier improves the merging, so that there's a lot less abrupt, quick turns and quick lane changes. So that's going to help out for a lot of people who are coming into the area. The other key thing is allowing people to exit off of the highway in an easier fashion. So say they missed their exit. I know a lot of people, and I've been in Sacramento for most of my life, have missed maybe a 16th Street exit.
I was thinking the same exact exit.
Or maybe the 26th Street exit. How about that? And then so you'll be allowed to continue and maybe exit at the very next one, without necessarily disrupting the traffic flow, because it's still a heavy traffic flow. Like you were talking about that interchange from Business 80, 99. It's quite an interchange that puts a lot of traffic and a lot of stress on the infrastructure. So that's part of it, is that you're not necessarily going to have to stress out. You can just make that very next exit down the way a little bit and turn back around to try to get back, so that we're hopefully not pressuring people to try to get over so soon.
When it comes to the carpool lanes, the HOV lanes, are they going to be the same as the ones that we see in the Bay Area, meaning that you have to pay a fee to use them or higher prices during peak commute times?
At this point, they're just regular carpool lanes that we have planned for this area, much like you see on I-5. Hmm. What you see is one lane dedicated for bus and carpool users, van pool users, electrical vehicle users. Those are going to be designated for them to use, and there are no plans to meter at this point.
The project, Fix 50, it's also increasing the clearance, right, of crossings, 7 crossings, I believe. What have been some of the past problems with that, and how will that help in the future?
Well, what you have is that because of the limited space that it takes for commercial vehicles to try to clear, they have to take a longer route. So what happens is they go to only the areas of highway infrastructure that allow them to be able to access getting onto the highway, which could take longer, right? It's going to add on to more time. So that Amazon delivery that you're waiting for, if it's in one of those large transport vehicles that's coming from a different city, has to take a longer route. So US 50 is going to allow for more commercial traffic. And I know that doesn't sound or bode well to people, but keep in mind that the infrastructure has to be updated according to what times are. And what our times show is that we have a lot of commercial vehicles that need access onto US 50 to try to get up to Tahoe, to try to continue farther than Tahoe, into the next state like Nevada and onwards, and vice versa. When you're coming out of state and coming into Sacramento, you're going to need more space for these vehicles to travel. So I think that's going to be the biggest change that most people will see for commercial vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point. This is a very heavily trafficked stretch of Highway 50, and that brings up safety. I mean, this has been going on for 2.5 years. How have construction workers, have there been any injuries for construction workers that are out there with a lot of cars on the road?
You know, thankfully, we haven't had any serious injuries. There have been some really close calls. Unfortunately, the thing that's been really seen, and this is throughout the valley and probably throughout the state, is an increase in speed by motorists that are coming through the construction zones. It's really dangerous. That's one of the reasons why the speed limit was dropped, and it's no longer 65, but 55 miles per hour going through a construction zone. And even with the due diligence of the CHP, the California Highway Patrol, in patrolling these construction zones, and I got to give them kudos because they've done an amazing job. They have been writing in a ridiculous amount of citations to motorists who are traveling or through the work zone at a high rate of speed or driving recklessly. And so they've been doing their job, but we still continue to see just way too many people who are distracted, who are driving too fast, and they're not only putting our field workers at risk, but they're also putting other motorists at risk. So this is one thing that we've had to deal with since the beginning of the construction phase.
And this started during the peak of the pandemic in November of 2020. So you guys have also written out supply chain issues as well as inflation. I believe the project is almost $500 million. It stands at around $470 million. Everything's gone up with inflation, and I mentioned supply chain issues. Do you have a more concrete number for this project and how much it will ultimately cost?
You know, at this point, we are within budget, so I don't have an updated number. This is the number that we currently have. If that were to change, we'd obviously put the number out there because we're a transparent department and we want to make sure that taxpayers know what these projects are going to cost. But at this point, this project is within budget.
Finally, patience is a virtue, as they say. What can you tell drivers who use Highway 50, day in and day out, what the ultimate payoff will be once it's all said and done?
You know what? We've had a lot of people asking us how come we're doing quite a bit of the construction work at nighttime versus the daytime. So I'd like to address that issue. First of all, we actually tried to do a large number of the work during the daytime versus nighttime because we did not want to disturb the local community. Obviously, people need sleep because they need to go to work the next morning. But what we found out is because of the speeding issues that I just mentioned, and the way that the configuration and how much space is needed, there was just too many delays for the traffic volume. It's a heavily traffic volume that uses US 50. The backups were just kind of not allowable by anyone's standards, and the delays were even worse. Then it became a safety issue because commercial trucks were having a hard time speeding up after they've slowed down. And when we have our contractors trying to get in and out of a work area, we saw that it became a safety matter. So it was a difficult decision. We had to go ahead and go to nighttime work, and it's disrupted some people in the surrounding neighborhoods, and I could feel their frustration. And we appreciate their their patience and how much they've been able to put up with the changes on this project. But know that there was the main reason that we had to do this is because of the safety factor. When it's all said and done, you will have a smoother, easier commute. And the people of Sacramento will really appreciate that 50 is now one of the more modern highways in the whole state of California. So what we're hoping is that the local community can still put up with just a little bit more inconveniences. And we do appreciate all of what they've already done so far with. So we appreciate everyone's assistance and support in this project. And we're looking forward to finishing up here in late 2024.
Dennis Keaton is the public information officer for Caltrans, overseeing the Fix 50 project in Sacramento along Highway 50 through downtown. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you, Vicki.
You're listening to Insight here on NPR, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A new era at Sacramento State began this week. Dr. J. Luke Wood stepped on campus as the ninth president in Hornet history. This new role is a homecoming for the Sac State alum. President Wood stopped by the CAP Radio studios in June, which is located at Sac State, to share how his experience as a first-generation college student navigating both the foster care system and housing insecurity shapes his vision for the university.
I'm going to let you get things started because we're going to get to know you. Where would you like to begin?
Maybe with my experience at Sac State.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So as you mentioned, I went to Sacramento State. I am an alum of the campus, two-time alum, actually. So started in the 2000, did my bachelor's degree here, was very involved as a student in student leadership and student government in many different positions, fraternity, clubs and organizations, and met my wife, Vidara, here on campus, and then went on to get my master's degree here as well. And that kind of launched me into the career that I have today. So I owe a lot to Sac State. And so coming here is like a, when people say a full circle moment, I mean, it really is like the definition of a full circle moment. And it's one that's an incredible honor. Those who knew me, even back, you know, when I was a freshman, sophomore in college, they would have heard me say several times, many of my friends, in fact, even text me when they saw the announcement saying, you said that you wanted to be the president of Sac State. and I think it's important to talk about that just a little bit. It's not about the position. It's not about the title. For me, it was about the work that I know can be done at this institution. Sac State is an incredibly diverse campus. It is a wonderful environment. It took someone like me who, if you look at all like my background, right, I'm a black male student, former foster child. I struggled with food insecurity and housing insecurity. I was a first generation college student. And despite all those things that some people might say, hey, this student may not be as likely to be successful, Sac State made a success out of me. I was able to graduate, able to get my master's degree here. And so if Sac State can do that for me, I know what it can do for other students. And so it's about coming back and giving back to the community that gave so much to me.
When you decided to commit to Sac State and go to college, what were you like weighing other options with other university or was it just Sac State?
Yeah, actually, I was looking at two other institutions. So I was looking first at UC Santa Cruz. And that was really, I had a high school counselor who was really trying to push me to go there. And then I was also looking at Chico State because I have an identical twin brother, and he had been accepted into their music industry program. And so if we wanted to stay together, then we needed to go to Chico. And then I remember coming home one day, and I had just come back from Boys State, which is a program they have. It's a summer program here. It's now called Boys and Girls State that the American Legion puts on. You come to Sac State, you stay in the residence halls, you go to the Capitol. It's just a wonderful experience. And when that experience was over, I went home and I was like, hey, I'm sorry, Josh, my brother, I'm going to Sac State. And so we went back and forth, and eventually he said, okay, well, I'm going to Sac State too. And so we came together and we lived in the residence hall, in the same room together, actually in Jenkins Hall, for our first year in college.
It was like the American River and the trees on campus probably like cinched the deal for the both of you.
Yes.
You both grew up in foster care in McLeod, which is a small community, like less than 1,000 people. It's east of Mount Shasta, about an hour south of the Oregon border. How was growing up in a rural community as a child?
So when you grow up in a rural community, there's certainly incredible advantages, but there's also challenges that go along with that. So one, it was not a particularly diverse environment. And so me and my brother were the, you know, African-Americans in our school. We were that diverse representation. And so there was always, you know, challenges, you know, with racial dynamics. That being said, when you grow up in a small town, you get to know everyone. You get to participate in so many different things that you wouldn't be able to do. I got to do, you know, Future Business Leaders of America. I, you know, was a student body president for our small high school of 100 kids. You know, got to play every sport, football, basketball, soccer, track, tennis. I got to compete in downhill skiing. I mean, so the experience that you get in an environment like that is unique. But I would also say that it was just in general, the town is a wonderful place. Great people, great environment. And it's within that kind of small culture that you really have the opportunity to do things again that you wouldn't normally be able to do. I will say that the challenge was then going from a high school of 100 kids to a university of 30,000 was a big shock. And they always said, like, hey, you got to be ready. It's going to be a transition. But I wasn't fully prepared for what that would mean until I got here and I was on the ground. I wasn't used to the diversity.
Pretty overstimulating.
Yes, it was very overstimulating. I didn't know where I fit in. I didn't know what my place was. And so it took me a while during that first year to kind of find it. And I found it in student leadership and student government.
Yeah, and that builds confidence along the way, too.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with Daisy Gonzalez last year, and she's the deputy chancellor for the California Community College System. And she discussed navigating foster care as a child as well and how it really gave her a front row seat of the impact that institutions and people in positions of power can have on your lives at a very young age. And she learned at that young age that she needs to speak up for herself because of her lived experience. How did foster care shape how you experience and how you also view the world?
Well, in many different ways. I think the first way it impacted me was an understanding and appreciation for diversity. So that would be like one of the strong assets. So my family, I was born in Oakland. My biological mother was in prison, and me and my brother immediately became wards of the court in the foster care, moved up to far northern California, and my parents ended up, you know, adopting me and my brother. They ended up, you know, continuing to do foster care. So they had over 300 children in their home throughout the time they were in foster care. And on average, there was at least 14 of us in the home. And then across the street from us was a group home. So like this little section of town, right, in this small town with all these children with these backgrounds. But my brothers and sisters growing up were white, Black, Latinx, Pacific Islander. I had two sisters, one with fetal alcohol syndrome with a cognitive impairment, one with spina bifida who was in a wheelchair. And so like the diversity of us was something that I began to appreciate early on, which I think impacts the work that I do today. So I remember when we first moved to the town, when we went to school, the students were jokingly calling us the UN because it's like, boom, this big group of students from this, you know, diverse family coming into this homogenous town. So that was one thing that I learned. I think the other thing that I learned is that, you know, unfortunately, people have different experiences. And when you're, placed into foster care, there's real reasons why that occurs. And it's oftentimes because of neglect and abuse. And so I, you know, up front got to see some of the darker side of what happens to people. And so I think that gave me a heart for people who have also been, you know, through different challenges and different experiences that are less than ideal. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I'm like really committed to students who have backgrounds like, for example, our undocumented students, our students who are current or former foster youth, those who have been justice impacted, who have been either, formerly incarcerated themselves or have had family members. And so I just have a natural heart for that because when I see those students, I see me. I see reflection of I see my brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And so I just have a different level of commitment.
Did it have a deeper impact going through your childhood with a twin brother and really the confidence that the both of you carried to take on these leadership roles at such a young age, the both of you? I mean, you even mentioned you were like student body president.
Yeah. For me, it's interesting because I had a lot of kind of racial dynamics and challenges outside of school. School became my safe haven. And so whereas other people might find that safe place outside of an academic learning environment, for me, other than a few examples of maybe some educators who weren't as ideal as they should have been, it's where I found my place in my home. And so in high school, being able to be in student leadership, that was an important experience for me. It gave me a lot of confidence. And then it sent me to Boy State. You know, I was involved in Boy Scouts. Me and my twin brother were Eagle Scouts. So, you know, we got to have that full experience. And then going off to Sac State, then it was like, okay, you're no longer like this natural leader in this environment. You're just one of thousands of students. And so that was a big, hard reset for me. And then once I found student government here, Associated Students Incorporated, ASI, I fell in love with it. And so during my freshman year of college, we basically was looking at, okay, what ways can I get involved? And I was volunteering in student government. And then there was a gentleman who was putting together a new team of people who were going to run and try to focus on issues of diversity, equity, inclusion. And he was putting together Slate, and his name is Artemio Pimentel, who is now the president of Folsom Lake College. And I joined his team and met all kinds of different people who are doing amazing things around Sacramento, like Eric Guerra, who's the city council member.
Yeah. Or vice mayor, right.
Yes. Robbie Abalon, who is a former deputy secretary of state. Joe Patterson, who is, you know, now an assembly member. And so it's this incredible network of people who are doing great work and who are in many ways still committed to the same kind of ideals that we had back then, but just operationalizing it in our different spaces.
What is it about Sacramento then? Because it means that people were educated here and they chose to stay here, you know, at a time. And we've had these conversations many times on Insight about having the city grow beyond, you know, a capital city town, you know, expanding industries, you know, and Sac State is integral in that. But you all stuck around or you're coming back, you know, well before all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was the ethos at the time. You know, the tagline for the university when I was a student here was leadership begins here. And it's interesting because if you look, I'm not going to say which CSUs, but other CSUs began taking that tagline and trying to use it in a similar way through their own institution because it's a really good way of thinking about what you're trying to do. And so I really think that there was a culture back then that really supported students and student development and student success. I think faculty were committed to student learning. I had some of the most amazing teachers when I was here at Sac State. And what the wonderful thing is, some of them are still here, still teaching and still doing the good work. In fact, one professor that stands out in my mind was a professor in criminal justice, Dr. Cecil Canton. And I remember I walked up, I was on campus during my freshman year, and I was walking outside the quad, and he just walked up to me and said, "Hello, how are you doing?" I was like, and it was, to me, it was kind of an odd experience just having a professor walk up to you and say hi. He introduced himself. I introduced myself. And he said, "You know, my name's Dr. Canton, and I just want you to know that if you ever need anything, that you can come and talk to me." And I never had a single class from him. In fact, I was, as a student, I was scared because he was known for very difficult courses. And so I never actually took a single class from him, but he was and continues to be even to this day, one of the most important influential people in my life. And so if you can have an environment where educators see themselves as being responsible for you, even if you're not in their classroom, that says a lot about the culture here in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's really profound. You know, you were also part of Sac State's Educational Opportunity Program, and that's a program that helps low-income students be able to succeed, because there's a lot of barriers outside of just covering tuition, and even that is expensive for a lot of people. What were the biggest barriers you faced as a student, you know, going from a small town to being kind of like a, what is it, like a, you know, a fish in the sea of like 30,000 students, and then having to navigate barriers like financial barriers?
Yeah, I mean, for me, some of the biggest challenges were around food insecurity and housing insecurity. So this was long before campuses had food pantries and clothing closets and basic needs centers and economic crisis response teams. This was in the era where people just tried to do what they could do. And so during my sophomore year of college, junior year, I definitely struggled with those issues. So my brother, you know, he was, you know, living in his car or would live in his office in student government. I, you know, stayed in my car. I had an older brother. I would stay in his garage. But that wasn't even the biggest challenge, was housing. For me, it was around food. I would sometimes go 2-3 days without eating. And I get to the point where I was so hungry that I would just start scrounging change off the ground. And, you know, there's that Taco Bell near campus. I would walk to the Taco Bell. You could get a bean burrito for 69 cents and a cup of water. And that's what I would do to basically stay afloat. So when they would have events on campus and there would be free food at campus, I would go to every single one of those events because it was oftentimes the difference between me eating or not. And I'll say I learned about all sorts of different things that I didn't know even existed because I went to these events on campus to essentially provide for, you know, my basic needs. In EOP, I had during my freshman year, a learning advisor who really noticed this, right, and noticed that we were having some challenges around it. And she would always, like, bring me and my brother, like, a box of food. And like to make sure that we were taken care of, or, you know, after class, if there was a, you know, restaurant nearby, hey, I'm going there. Do you want to come? And, you know, we'd always play it off like we're fine, we're okay, because, you know, we didn't want to be seen as like people in need of support, even though we really did. And she always knew like ways to essentially navigate around that. Like, hey, I'm going. Well, don't let me be by myself. Right. So she always made it where we were there to make sure that she, you know, that we're checking on her. But really, she was just trying to support us. And then it goes to from there, advisors that I had in EOP who, you know, academic advising, you know, was something that was really important to me. Getting tutoring was really important. And one of the reasons that was important is because I was a really good student my first couple of years. But then as the basic needs issues became stronger, I got to the point where my grades weren't the best. And they helped me navigate around some really difficult issues that could have, for some students and some institutions that don't care about them, could have led to them leaving. And so I really believe, and I say this to this day, I would not have been made at Sac State had it not been for EOP. And what is really beautiful is that some of the people who were central to me being able to navigate the institution and eventually graduate are still here today. And when I see them, I just get such just a level of excitement, but also it just reconfirms my responsibility to do for others what they did for me.
Yeah, an even bigger full circle moment. You're literally going back to campus, seeing these familiar faces that really shaped your youth and your young adulthood and the work that you do today. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. J. Luke Wood, president of Sacramento State University. What is your impression of outgoing President Robert Nelson?
I think he has been an amazing president. And I would say that it's unquestionable that he is one of the best presidents this university has ever had, unquestionably. And one of the things that stands out to me is the work they've done around graduation rates and student success. When I was here as a student, the graduation rate for Black male students was around 4%. I look at when he started here, it was around 8% overall for students, 8%. And that's a 4-year graduation rate. And they have raised it to 28%, nearly 30% during his tenure. So think about the systems work, the policy work, the hard work that they've had to do in order to get to that point. And so what I see is an incredible foundation that he set in that area that's really going to be important for us to move forward into the next phase of that work so that we can get from 30% to 50%, from 50% to 55%, and to continue to move in that positive direction. The other thing that I think he's done is he's created a sense of community in a way that wasn't here before. Like when you would say that, hey, I'm a graduate of Sac State, or you know, I'm affiliated with Sac State in some way, people say, oh, that's great. Now you mention Sac State, and the first thing that people do is they say, "Stingers up,"
yeah,
right?
Exactly, I know.
Yeah. And it's a positive thing. It's
course.
A unifying thing. And you know, that was something that was, you know, that had been a part of the campus for some time, and then it was lost to history, and then he brought it back in a way that was powerful and unifying, I think, at a time when people really needed that. And so when I look at the work around student success, I look at the work around community building, and even just the general commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion, again, he is unquestionably one of the best presidents this campus has ever had. And I feel honored to be able to follow him.
He wears his heart on his sleeve.
He does.
Also. That is an understatement. You're coming to us from San Diego State University. Aside from being part of the Cal State system, are there similarities between campus culture, educational goals, demographics that stand out to you?
Well, demographics certainly stands out to me. So San Diego State University is a Hispanic-serving institution, which is a federal designation that is used for campuses that have a high enrollment of students from the Latinx community. San Diego State is also an Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander serving institution, an ANAPESI is what we call that, which is also a federal designation based upon serving Asian and Pacific Islander students. Sacramento State just happens to be both of those same things, an HSI and an ANAPESI. And when I look at the demographics, there's actually a lot of similarities in the student population, which I think is an opportunity because we've been able to do some really good work around student success at San Diego State and campus climate and campus culture for students. So I think that there's some similar things that we can look to there. There's also a lot of differences. San Diego State has a much larger budget than Sacramento State. San Diego State is on the path to becoming a Research One institution. Sacramento State certainly has amazing researchers who do great work. And in fact, I'm a byproduct of some of those faculty who have been engaged in really critical translational applied research. The portfolio, though, of research does look different. So we are also, you know, at San Diego State in the Mountain West Conference. And you know, as it has been alluded to in the news, there's exploration, at least there's rumor of that, of other things and other conferences potentially. And if you look at Sacramento State, we're in the Big Sky. And so there's big differences in terms of athletics, in terms of resources, and in terms of research that do separate the campuses. But I also think that those differences are okay. It's not Sacramento State doesn't need to be San Diego State. It just needs to be the best Sacramento State that Sacramento State can be. And certainly there are elements of what I saw at San Diego State that I hope to be able to bring here to campus. But I also recognize that it's a totally different environment, a totally different culture, a totally different mission, and it doesn't need to be the next San Diego State. It just needs to be the best Sacramento State it can be.
Yeah, and you want to expand upon the strides that Sac State has made in graduation rates, student enrollment, diversity in both student body and faculty. You know, those are big goals of yours. But come next year, what are some tangible goals you want to check off? I don't know if you have like a post-it, you know, you look at it like a vision board, and come, you know, graduation of 2024, you're like, okay, I can check that off.
Well, I think the most important thing that any new president should do is to listen. So I do plan on kicking off 100 days of listening, where I'm going to learn from faculty, staff, and students and community members. You know, what are the opportunities that they see? What are the challenges? Where do we want to be in the next 3 to 5 years? And I think that those are important conversations that if you come in saying that we're going to do these four things, then you're probably not being attentive to really learning about the environment. I can say that student success, regardless, will be a core element, and a focus on equity within that will be a core element of what we do. There's two reasons for that. One, we're part of the CSU system, and there's what's called Graduation 2025, which is a system-wide initiative to increase graduation rates and to reduce equity gaps, that's differences in performance between students of color and their peers. So because we're part of the system, that is naturally going to be what we need to continue and we need to focus on. But even more importantly, we need to do that and continue that focus, because that's why we're here. If a student can't come into this institution, and their family can't drop them off and know that they're going to have a great likelihood of being able to learn, grow, develop, graduate, and then go into the labor market and be able to change their lives for themselves and for their families, then we're not doing our job. And so that will absolutely be a focus. I can also say that I'm a big fan, a big proponent of college athletics. And so continuing to, you know, to further the work that's been done. There's a great athletic director here, Mark Orr, and also, you know, great coaches, great student athletes. I can't wait to be able to meet more of them than I have already. And I think that those are opportunities for us to further that, because athletics oftentimes serves as the front door to the campus for the community. It's an opportunity for people to come together and to learn more about the institution and to engage, to learn more about what's taking place, you know, certainly in the athletic enterprise, but in the academic enterprise. It's an opportunity for philanthropy. It's an opportunity also for enrollment. At San Diego State, that's one of the things that we've seen. Our great athletic prowess has led to increased enrollment, increased applications, and also increased yield. And yield is something that most people may not totally understand, but it really matters. So a student is accepted to multiple institutions across the country. And a student then has a choice, which campus am I going to go to? Sometimes that decision is based solely on scholarships that are available. Sometimes it's based upon campus life, which includes athletics. And sometimes it's based upon the climate and culture. If you have athletics and a great campus culture, it draws in more students and can help with enrollment. Sacramento State is unique. It's one of the few campuses in the system that met their enrollment targets. That is unique across the system, where other campuses are struggling, and that's resulting in some pretty significant budget cuts. So it's an opportunity for us to use that to bring in more students, to bring in more shine to the campus, to advance philanthropy. And so I'll definitely continue to be a proponent of athletics.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you, Dr. Wood.
Thank you for having me.
And that was my conversation with Sacramento State President J. Luke Wood, who began at the university this week. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An annual tradition celebrating the bounty of California is in full swing this month. The California State Fair has called CalExpo and Sacramento home for more than 50 years. From rides to music, juggernaut food like corn dogs, including some California beer and wine, there is a lot to choose from. Darla Gibbons is with the California State Fair and Food Festival, which runs through July 30th. Good morning, Darla.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks so much for having us this morning.
Thanks for taking the time. A very, very busy time for you. What is the theme of this year's State Fair?
The theme this year is Summer is Here, and it's the biggest kickoff to summer. 17 days of family-friendly fun, lots of activities. And yes, we know it's hot in July, but we got you covered with some cooling stations and also our air-conditioned buildings with all of the exhibits that we can go into in just a bit.
Yeah, I don't think we have to go that too far in hindsight to be like, Sunday was a record-setting temperature day for Sacramento, and Saturday really didn't offer much relief, and Friday was like at or flirting with 100 degrees, I think, and that was your opening weekend. What was the attendance like?
You know what? We had our rushes during the morning, and then again in the evening, we would see people migrating into the buildings. I go out on the grounds, and I'm like, wait, where is everybody? And then I'd go inside to find a cinnamon roll. And I'm like, oh, here's everyone. So the people are planning and preparing for that heat. They'll come in the morning, they'll go inside the buildings when it starts getting warm, and then they'll start migrating back out. And then also last night, it looked as if I went out there at around 7 o'clock in the evening because folks were coming for the concert. There was a line down the main loop waiting for people to get in. So last night was a cool evening and it was packed. Mm.
Is there a reason why the state fair is usually this time of year? Because this isn't the first time I've talked to the state fair about, you know, the summer heat.
Unfortunately, it doesn't matter right now, any time that we have the fair in the summer, because of our changing climate, it's hot no matter what. I even looked at temperatures last year in August because, you know, initially the state fair would start weeks before the Labor Day weekend. And I checked last year just to see how temperatures were in August. It was just as hot in August as it was in July. And what happened when we changed the time frame of the California State Fair, I want to say at least 12 years ago or so, schools were going year round. And with schools going year round, it impacted them being able to show at their county fairs and then eventually coming here to the California State Fair to show their market priced animals. And that's why the fair was started years ago, is to show the new products in agriculture and technology. And it has just advanced and grown over the years.
Yeah, there are a lot of logistics outside of just the state fair that are involved in this.
And it also has to do with the racing schedule as well. But as you know, because of the temperatures last weekend, we made the call based on our state veterinarian to suspend racing for last weekend. And this weekend, of course, we're paying attention to the temperatures and we'll guide that, get a guide from the veterinarian once again, as if we're going to continue with racing this weekend or suspend it. So we'll definitely keep everyone posted on that.
When it comes to admission, I believe the standard admission is $14, and that could add up for a family. What does the $14 admission get you?
Well, it's actually $16. $16, it gets you an entire day of fun. And once you get inside, there are free things that you can participate in. For example, we have our Taster's Row, where you can get samples from our commercial award-winning olive oils and cheeses. And we have walnuts. We have produce that's grown right here in the California region, especially the Central Valley area, which is, you know, one of the farm capitals of the world. So we do have free samplings. We have Upper Crust Bakery. They're out of Davis, and they come in and they bake fresh bread every morning. And so you go into the California building, it's like, oh, wow, what is that fragrance? So they also have samplings of their bread as well. And not to mention the entertainment. We have seven stages located across the fairgrounds, and all of that entertainment is free. In addition to those stage acts, we have singers, we have dancers, we have community performers who come and show their talents off. And we have grounds acts that walk around the grounds and entertain folks, mm-hmm. including, say, the strolling pianos. We have two pianos that are playing and strolling along the fairground. So there's lots to do. And considering we're open during the week from 11 to 10, where else can you go for 12, 13 hours and enjoy all of this entertainment?
Given that there's just so much to do and it's such a large place, that can be kind of overwhelming for a family or a person. What do you recommend are the best deals or ways that people and families can cut costs when they're spending the day at the fair?
So there's a couple of things that you can do. Come on particular days. On Mondays, we have Smud Giving Mondays. We just had it this past weekend. And if you bring in five canned good items or non-perishable items, you can get into the California State Fair and Food Festival for free. And it's a win-win situation. You're bringing in some non-perishables, and that's going to help another family with the Elk Grove Food Bank. Because unfortunately, during the summer months, you know, people are on vacations, they're not thinking about giving. And that's when we see our food banks in the area have a depletion in their donations. So this is a way that we can invite our community to help out and come inside the fair and have a great time, but help families as well. And then on Tuesdays, and we have another SMUT Giving Money coming up next Monday on July 24th. It's each Monday of the fair. On Tuesdays, we have our Kids Day. That's where children 12 and under get into the fair for free. And we also have $2 rides for everyone. So you go map out which rides you want to ride, get the amount of tickets that you need, and have at it. Lots of fun across the area. And then next Thursday, we have our Military Veterans and First Responders Appreciation Day. Any military veteran or first responder with a valid ID will get into the California State Fair and Food Festival for free. And we have special programs set up on that day as well.
Well, thank you so much, Darla. You gave us a good, a brief itinerary for all the stuff that's happening at the State Fair. Darla Givens is with the California State Fair and Food Festival. It runs through July 30th, so you have plenty of time to check out the State Fair. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.